and now you've read it. So we've already eaten into the mere 99 hours a year an average American adult spends reading a book, compared with 1,460 hours watching television. I've also read that only 11% of the American public bothers to read a daily newspaper beyond the funny pages or the used car ads. So if you live in a country where 44 million can't read, and perhaps close to another 200 million can read but usually don't, well, friends, you and I are living in one very scary place. A nation that not only churns out illiterate students, but goes out of its way to remain ignorant and stupid, is a nation that should not be running the world, at least not until a majority of its citizens can locate Kosovo or any other country it has bombed on the map. It comes as no surprise to foreigners that Americans who love to revel in their stupidity would elect a president who rarely reads anything, including his own briefing papers, and thinks Africa is a nation, not a continent. An idiot leader of an idiot nation. In our glorious land of plenty, less is always more when it comes to taxing any lobe of the brain with the intake of facts and numbers, critical thinking, or the comprehension of anything that isn't, well, sports. Our idiot-in-chief does nothing to hide his ignorance. He even brags about it. During his commencement address to the Yale class of 2001, George W. Bush spoke proudly of having been a mediocre student at Yale. And to the C students, I say you too can be president of the United States. The part where you also need an ex-president father, a brother as governor of a state with missing ballots, and a Supreme Court full of your dad's buddies must have been too complicated to bother with in a short speech. As Americans, we have quite a proud tradition of being represented by ignorant, high-ranking officials. In 1956, President Dwight D. Eisenhower's nominee as ambassador to Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, was unable to identify either the country's prime minister or its capital during his Senate confirmation hearing. Not a problem. Maxwell Gluck was confirmed anyway. In 1981, President Ronald Reagan's nominee for Deputy Secretary of State, William Clark, admitted to a wide-ranging lack of knowledge about foreign affairs at his confirmation hearing. Clark had no idea how our allies in Western Europe felt about having American nuclear missiles based there, and didn't know the names of the prime ministers of South Africa or Zimbabwe. Not to worry, he was confirmed too. All this just paved the way for Baby Bush, who hadn't quite absorbed the names of the leaders of India or Pakistan, two of the seven nations that possess the atomic bomb. And Bush went to Yale and Harvard. Recently, a group of 556 seniors at 55 prestigious American universities, for example, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, were given a multiple-choice test consisting of questions that were described as high school level. 34 questions were asked. These top students could only answer 53% of them correctly, and only one student got them all right. A whopping 40% of these students did not know when the Civil War took place, even when given a wide range of choices, A, 1750 to 1800, B, 1800 to 1850, C, 1850 to 1900, D, 1900 to 1950, or E, after 1950. The answer is actually C, guys. The two questions the college seniors scored highest on were, one, who is Snoop Doggy Dog? 98% got that one right. And two, who are Beavis and Butthead? 99% knew. For my money, Beavis and Butthead represented some of the best American satire of the 90s, and Snoop and his fellow rappers have much to say about America's social ills, so I'm not going down the road of blaming MTV. What I am concerned with is why politicians, like Senators Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and Herbert Kohl of Wisconsin, want to go after MTV when they are the ones responsible for the massive failure of American education. Walk into any public school, and the odds are good that you'll find overflowing classrooms, leaking ceilings, and demoralized teachers. In 1 out of 4 schools, you'll find students learning from textbooks published in the 1980s or earlier. Why is this? Because the political leaders and the people who vote for them have decided it's a bigger priority to build another bomber than to educate our children. They would rather hold hearings about the depravity of a television show called Jackass than about their own depravity in neglecting our schools and children and maintaining our title as dumbest country on earth. I hate writing these words. I love this big lug of a country and the crazy people in it. But when I can travel to some backwater village in Central America, as I did back in the 80s, and listen to a bunch of 12-year-olds tell me their concerns about the World Bank, I get the feeling that something is lacking in the United States of America. Our problem isn't just that our kids don't know nothing, but that the adults who pay their tuition are no better. I wonder what would happen if we tested the U.S. Congress to see just how much our representatives know. What if we were to give a pop quiz to the commentators who cram our TVs and radios with all their nonstop nonsense? How many would they get right? A while back, I decided to find out. It was one of those Sunday mornings when the choice on TV was the Parade of Homes real estate show or the McLaughlin Group. If you like the sound of hyenas on Dexedrine, of course, you go with McLaughlin. On this particular Sunday morning, perhaps as my punishment for not being at Mass, I was forced to listen to magazine columnist Fred Barnes, now an editor at the right-wing Weekly Standard and co-host of the Fox News show The Beltway Boys, whine on and on about the sorry state of American education, blaming the teachers and their evil union for why students are doing so poorly. "These kids don't even know what the Iliad and the Odyssey are," he bellowed, as the other panelists nodded in admiration at Fred's noble lament. The next morning, I called Fred Barnes at his Washington office. "Fred," I said, "tell me what the Iliad and the Odyssey are." He started hemming and hawing. "Well, okay, fine, you got me. I don't know what they're about. Happy now?" "No, not really. You're one of the top TV pundits in America, seen every week on your own show and plenty of others. You gladly hawk your wisdom to hundreds of thousands of unsuspecting citizens, gleefully scorning others for their ignorance. Yet you and your guests know little or nothing yourselves. Grow up, get some books, and go to your room. Yale and Harvard, Princeton and Dartmouth, Stanford and Berkeley. Get a degree from one of those universities and you're set for life. So what if, on the test of the college seniors I previously mentioned, 70% of the students at those fine schools had never heard of the Voting Rights Act or President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society initiatives? Who needs to know stuff like that as you sit in your Tuscan villa watching the sunset and checking how well your portfolio did today? So what if not one of these top universities that the ignorant students attend requires that they take even one course in American history to graduate? Who needs history when you're going to be tomorrow's mastery of the universe? Who cares if 70% of those who graduate from America's colleges are not required to learn a foreign language? Isn't the rest of the world speaking English now? And if they aren't, hadn't all those damn foreigners better get with the program? And who gives a rat's ass if out of the 70 English literature programs at 70 major American universities, only 23 now require English majors to take a course in Shakespeare? Can somebody please explain to me what Shakespeare and English have to do with each other? What good are some moldy old plays going to be in the business world anyway? Maybe I'm just jealous because I don't have a college degree. Yes, I, Michael Moore, am a college dropout. Well, I never officially dropped out. One day in my sophomore year, I drove around and around the various parking lots of our commuter campus in Flint, searching desperately for a parking space. There simply was no place to park. Every spot was full, and no one was leaving. After a frustrating hour spent circling around in my 69 Chevy Impala, I shouted out the window, "That's it! I'm dropping out!" I drove home, and I told my parents I was no longer in college. "Why?" they asked. "Couldn't find a parking spot," I replied, grabbing a red pop and moving on with the rest of my life. I haven't sat at a school desk since. My dislike of school started somewhere around the second month of first grade. My parents, and God bless them forever for doing this, had taught me to read and write by the time I was four, so when I entered St. John's Elementary School, I had to sit and feign interest while the other kids like robots sang A, B, C, D, E, F, G, now I know my ABCs, tell me what you think of me. Every time I heard that line, I wanted to scream out, here's what I think of you, quit singing that damn song, somebody get me a Twinkie. I was bored beyond belief. The nuns, to their credit, recognized this, and one day Sister John Catherine took me aside and said that they had decided to skip me up to second grade, effective immediately. I was thrilled. When I got home, I excitedly announced to my parents that I had already advanced a grade in my first month of school. They seemed underwhelmed by this new evidence of my genius. Instead, they let out a, "What the?" and then went into the kitchen and closed the door. I could hear my mother on the phone explaining to the Mother Superior that there was no way her little Michael was going to be attending class with kids bigger and older than him. So please, sister, put him back in first grade. I was crushed. My mother explained to me that if I skipped first grade, I'd always be the youngest and littlest kid in class all through my school years. Well, inertia and fast food eventually proved her wrong on that count. There would be no appeals to my father, who left most education decisions to my mother, the valedictorian of her high school class. I tried to explain that if I was sent back to first grade, it would appear that I'd flunked second grade on my first day, putting myself at risk of having the crap beaten out of me by the first graders I'd left behind with a rousing, "See ya, suckers!" But Mom wasn't falling for it. It was then I learned that the only person with higher authority than Mother Superior was Mother Moore. The next day, I decided to ignore all instructions from my parents to go back to first grade. In the morning, before the opening bell, all the students had to line up outside the school with their classmates and then march into the building in single file. Quietly but defiantly, I went and stood in the second graders' line, praying that God would strike the nuns blind so they wouldn't see which line I was in. The bell rang, and no one had spotted me. The second grade line started to move, and I went with it. Yes, I thought, if I can pull this off, if I can just get into that second grade classroom and take my seat, then nobody will be able to get me out of there. Just as I was about to enter the door of the school, I felt a hand grab me by the collar of my coat. It was Sister John Catherine. "I think you're in the wrong line, Michael," she said firmly. "You're now in first grade again." I began to protest. My parents had it all wrong, and those weren't really my parents, or... For the next 12 years I sat in class, did my work, and remained constantly preoccupied, looking for ways to bust out. I started an underground school paper in fourth grade. It was shut down. I started it again in sixth. It was shut down. In eighth grade, I not only started the paper again, I convinced the good sisters to let me write a play for our class to perform at the Christmas pageant. The play had something to do with how many rats occupied the parish hall and how all the rats in the country had descended on St. John's Parish Hall to have their annual rat convention. The priest put a stop to that one and shut down the paper again. Instead, my friends and I were told to go up on stage and sing three Christmas carols and then leave the stage without uttering a word. I organized half the class to go up there and utter nothing. So we stood there and refused to sing the carols, our silent protest against censorship. By the second song, intimidated by the stern looks from their parents in the audience, most of the protesters joined in on the singing. And by the third song, I too had capitulated, joining in on O Holy Night, and promising myself to live to fight another day. High school, as we all know, is some sort of sick, sadistic punishment of kids by adults, seeking vengeance because they can no longer lead the responsibility-free, screwing-around 24/7 lives young people enjoy. What other explanation could there be for those 4 brutal years of degrading comments, physical abuse, and the belief that you're the only one not having sex? As soon as I entered high school and the public school system, all the grousing I'd done about the repression of the Sisters of St. Joseph was forgotten. Suddenly they all looked like scholars and saints. I was now walking the halls of a 2,000-plus inmate holding pen. Where the nuns had devoted their lives to teaching for no earthly reward, those running the public high school had one simple mission. Hunt these little pricks down like dogs, then cage them until we can either break their will or ship them off to the glue factory. Do this, don't do that. Tuck your shirt in. Wipe that smile off your face. Where's your hall pass? That's the wrong pass. You! Detention! One day I came home from school and picked up the paper. The headline read, 26th Amendment passes. Voting age lowered to 18. Below that was another headline, School Board President to retire. Seat up for election. I called the county clerk. I'm going to be 18 in a few weeks. If I can vote, does that mean I can also run for office? Oh, let me see, the lady replied. That's a new question. She ruffled through some papers and came back on the phone. Yes, she said, you can run. All you need to do is gather 20 signatures to place your name on the ballot. 20 signatures? That's it? I had no idea running for elective office required so little work. I got the 20 signatures, submitted my petition, and started campaigning. My platform? Fire the high school principal and the assistant principal. Alarmed at the idea that a high school student might actually find a legal means to remove the very administrators he was being paddled by, five local adults took out petitions and got themselves added to the ballot, too. Of course, they ended up splitting the older adult vote five ways. And I won, getting the vote of every single stoner between the ages of 18 and 25, who, though many would probably never vote again, relished the thought of sending their high school wardens to the gallows. The day after I won, I was walking down the hall at school. I had one more week to serve out as a student, and I passed the assistant principal, my shirt tail proudly untucked. "Good morning, Mr. Moore," he said tersely. The day before, my name had been Hey, you. Now I was his boss. Within 9 months after I took my seat on the school board, the principal and assistant principal had submitted their letters of resignation, a face-saving device employed when one is asked to step down. A couple of years later, the principal suffered a heart attack and died. I had known this man, the principal, for many years. When I was 8 years old, he used to let me and my friends skate and play hockey on this little pond beside his house. He was kind and generous, and always left the door to his house open in case any of us needed to change into our skates or if we got cold and just wanted to get warm. Years later, I was asked to play bass in a band that was forming, but I didn't own a bass. He let me borrow his son's. I offer this to remind myself that all people are actually good at their core, and remember that someone with whom I grew to have serious disputes was also someone with a free cup of hot chocolate for us shivering little brats from the neighborhood. Teachers are now the politician's favorite punching bag. To listen to the likes of Chester Finn, the former Assistant Secretary of Education in Bush the Elder's administration, you'd think all that has crumbled in our society can be traced back to lax, lazy, and incompetent teachers. If you put out a 10 most wanted list of who's killing American education, I'm not sure who you would have higher on the list. The teachers' union or the education school faculties, Finn said. Sure, there are a lot of teachers who suck, and they'd be better suited to making telemarketing calls for Amway. But the vast majority are dedicated educators who have chosen a profession that pays them less than what some of their students earn selling ecstasy. And for that sacrifice, we seek to punish them. I don't know about you, but I want the people who have the direct attention of my child more hours a day than I do, treated with tender, loving care. Those are my kids they're preparing for this world, so why on earth would I want to piss them off? You would think society's attitude would be something like this. Teachers, thank you so much for devoting your life to my child. Is there anything I can do to help you? Is there anything you need? I'm here for you. Why? Because you are helping my child, my baby, learn and grow. Not only will you be largely responsible for her ability to make a living, but your influence will greatly affect how she views the world, what she knows about other people in this world, and how she will feel about herself. I want her to believe she can attempt anything, that no doors are closed, and that no dreams are too distant. I am entrusting the most valuable person in my life to you for 7 hours each day. You are thus one of the most important people in my life. Thank you. No, Instead, this is what teachers hear. You've got to wonder about teachers who claim to put the interests of children first, then look to milk the system dry through wage hikes. The New York Post, 12/26/2000. Estimates of the number of bad teachers range from 5% to 18% of the 2.6 million total. Michael Chapman, Investors Business Daily, 9/21/98. Most education professionals belong to a closed community of devotees who follow popular philosophies rather than research on what works. Douglas Carminan, quoted in the Montreal Gazette, January 6, 2001. Teachers' unions have gone to bat for felons and teachers who have had sex with students, as well as those who simply couldn't teach. Peter Schweitzen, National Review, 8/17/98. What kind of priority do we place on education in America? Oh, it's on the funding list, somewhere down between OSHA and meat inspectors. The person who cares for our child every day receives an average of $41,351 annually. A congressman who cares only about which tobacco lobbyist is taking him to dinner tonight receives $145,100. Considering the face-slapping society gives our teachers on a daily basis, is it any wonder so few choose the profession? The national teacher shortage is so big that some school systems are recruiting teachers outside the United States. Chicago recently recruited and hired teachers from 28 foreign countries, including China, France, and Hungary. By the time the new term begins in New York City, 7,000 veteran teachers will have retired, and 60% of the new teachers hired to replace them are uncertified. But here's the kicker for me. 163 New York City schools opened the 2000-2001 school year without a principal. You heard right, school with no one in charge. Apparently, the mayor and the school board are experimenting with chaos theory. Throw 500 poor kids into a crumbling building and watch nature take its course. In the city from which most of the wealth in the world is controlled, where there are more millionaires per square foot than there is gum on the sidewalk, we somehow can't find the money to pay a starting teacher more than $31,900 a year. And we act surprised when we can't get results. And it's not just teachers who have been neglected. American schools are literally falling apart. In 1999, one quarter of U.S. public schools reported that the condition of at least one of their buildings was inadequate. In 1997, the entire Washington, D.C. school system had to delay the start of school for 3 weeks because nearly one-third of the schools were found to be unsafe. Almost 10% of U.S. public schools have enrollments that are more than 25% greater than the capacity of their permanent buildings. Classes have to be held in the hallways, outdoors, in the gym, in the cafeteria. One school I visited even held classes in a janitor's closet. It's not as if the janitor's closets are being used for anything related to cleaning anyway. In New York City, almost 15% of the 1,100 public schools are without full-time custodians, forcing teachers to mop their own floors and students to do without toilet paper. We already send our kids out into the street to hawk candy bars so their schools can buy band instruments. What's next? Car washes to raise money for toilet paper? Further proof of just how special our little offspring are is the number of public and even school libraries that have been shut down or had their hours cut back. The last thing we need is a bunch of kids hanging around a bunch of books. Apparently, President Bush agrees. In his first budget, he proposed cutting federal spending on libraries by $39 million, down to $168 million, a nearly 19% reduction. Just the week before, his wife, former school librarian Laura Bush, kicked off a national campaign for America's libraries, calling them community treasure chests loaded with a wealth of information available to everyone equally. The president's mother, Barbara Bush, heads the Foundation for Family Literacy. Well, there's nothing like having firsthand experience with illiteracy in the family to motivate one into acts of charity. For kids who are exposed to books at home, the loss of a library is sad. But for kids who come from environments where people don't read, the loss of a library is a tragedy that might keep them from ever discovering the joys of reading, or from gathering the kind of information that will decide their lot in life. Jonathan Kozol, for decades an advocate for disadvantaged children, has observed that school libraries remain the clearest window to a world of non-commercial satisfactions and enticements that most children in poor neighborhoods will ever know. Kids deprived of access to good libraries are also being kept from developing the information skills they need to keep up in workplaces that are increasingly dependent on rapidly changing information. The ability to conduct research is probably the most essential skill today's students can have, says Julie Walker, executive director of the American Association of School Librarians. The knowledge students acquire in school is not going to serve them throughout their lifetimes. Many of them will have 4 to 5 careers in a lifetime. It will be their ability to navigate information that will matter. Who's to blame for the decline in libraries? Well, when it comes to school libraries, you can start by pointing the finger, yes, that finger, at Richard Nixon. From the 1960s until 1974, school libraries received specific funding from the government. But in 1974, the Nixon administration changed the rules, stipulating that federal education money be doled out in block grants to be spent by states however they choose. Few states chose to spend the money on libraries, and the downslide began. This is one reason that materials in many school libraries today date from the 1960s and early 1970s before funding was diverted. No, Sally, the Soviet Union isn't our enemy. The Soviet Union has been kaput for 10 years. This 1999 account by an Education Week reporter about the library at a Philadelphia elementary school could apply to any number of similarly neglected schools. Even the best books in the library at T.M. Pierce Elementary School are dated, tattered, and discolored. The worst, many in a latter stage of disintegration, are dirty and fetid and leave a moldy residue on hands and clothing. Chairs and tables are old, mismatched, or broken. There isn't a computer in sight. Outdated facts and theories and offensive stereotypes leap from the authoritative pages of encyclopedias and biographies, fiction and nonfiction tomes. Among the volumes on these shelves, a student would find it all but impossible to locate accurate information on AIDS or other contemporary diseases, explorations of the moon and Mars, or the past 5 United States presidents. The ultimate irony in all of this is that the very politicians who refuse to fund education in America adequately are the same ones who go ballistic over how our kids have fallen behind the Germans, the Japanese, and just about every other country with running water and an economy not based on the sale of chiclets. Suddenly, they want accountability. They want the teachers held responsible and to be tested. And they want the kids to be tested over and over and over. There's nothing terribly wrong with the concept of using standardized testing to determine whether kids are learning to read and write and do math. But too many politicians and education bureaucrats have created a national obsession with testing, as if everything that's wrong with the educational system in this country could be magically fixed if we could just raise those scores. The people who really should be tested, beside the yammering pundits, are the so-called political leaders. Next time you see your state representative or congressman, give him this pop quiz and remind him that any future pay raises will be based on how well he scores. Number one, what is the annual pay of your average constituent? The answer, $28,548. Two, what percent of welfare recipients are children? The answer, 67%. Number three, how many known species of plants and animals are on the brink of extinction? Number three, answer, 11,046. Number four, how big is the hole in the ozone layer? Answer, 10.5 million square miles.